We've come to a very, very good part of our study. We're going to talk about physical adjustment in marriage. That's a nice term for the physical relationship of marriage that is such a vital part of a couple's experience. I would say that their physical relationship amounts to somewhere around 25% to 40% of the success of a marriage, depending on their age and their temperament and their interest in the experience. But anyone who tells you it really isn't too important is kidding themselves, and I got a hunch they're not kidding their partner. And at the outset, let me offer you a novel idea. It is my conviction that the act of marriage, which is what I like to call the physical relationship between a husband and wife, is best enjoyed by Christians over anyone in our culture. Now let that thought sink in, because I'm going to prove it to you before I'm through today. We Christians don't have an obsession on sex, or certainly we shouldn't. We don't dwell on it constantly. We're not reading porno books, and we don't watch X-rated movies, and we don't use all this erotica and extra sensory, sensual stimulation. We just go on enjoying the relationship year after year after year the way our Heavenly Father intended. We don't brag about it. In fact, some of you probably never heard a minister talk about it before. You almost think it's a military secret. And the secular world thinks we don't understand. In fact, the secular world, they look upon us, they think we're so naive, we still think the stork brings them. But I think they're coming around to the realization that we are knowledgeable, except that we have learned something. And that is, sex without love is an animal experience, and inadequate to satisfy human beings. We live in a world where they have substituted sex for love. And we believe that if you're going to use the term sex, I don't like the term myself, as I'll give you a different term, but we believe that sex is merely an expression of love. It's to be a sublime expression. Now, I always save this talk for right after lunch for a couple of reasons. One is I find that's when folks are the sleepiest. You see, all of the blood has gone from your brain to your stomach to digest your food, and so your brain is kind of tired. And I figure if this subject won't keep you awake, sleep on. Let me give you a couple of ideas about it at the outset. Number one, the act of marriage, which is what I like to call the relationship, the act of marriage is a sacred experience. That is fundamental. If you don't understand that, you will never understand the uniqueness of that experience. I say it's sacred for three reasons. All three members of the triune God have commended it. As a matter of fact, God the Father commanded it in Genesis 1:23 when he said, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." And whether it's Adam and Eve or Mr. and Mrs. 20th century, there's only one way to plenish the earth. And that means then that God ordained the act of marriage before sin. Sin did not occur until Genesis chapter 3 when the fall arose or fell. And before that, we have the command to be fruitful and multiply, which means there is not one prohibition of God against the act of marriage. As we'll see, there are all kinds of prohibitions outside of marriage. Jesus, the Son, while he was on earth, said of the couple, "They two shall be one flesh," and that is the act of marriage, one flesh experience that produces another flesh. God has given us the unique capability of procreation. We can't create, we can only manufacture out of what God has created. But we can procreate in a unique manner as a Christian couple combines their love and expresses it in the God-ordained plan. They procreate another creature, a living creature, that has an eternal soul, a free will, and the capacity to procreate others. We're the only living creatures in all the universe that have that capacity. Now, others biologically perform, other living beings, but they don't have an eternal soul and a free will. We alone have that capacity. And Jesus Christ endorsed this. And as you know, it was at a wedding where he performed his first miracle, testifying again his endorsement of the husband-wife relationship. But the Holy Spirit has many times commended the husband-wife physical experience. In the book of Proverbs, for example, read the 15th chapter of Proverbs and you'll find that the act of marriage is not just for propagation, but for mutual pleasure. You'll find in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, much of the whole chapter is devoted to the sublime but very personal and intimate relationship between a husband and wife. And in every case, it commends the experience. But I think the most significantly open mention of it in the whole Scripture by the Holy Spirit is Hebrews 13:4. Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled. Now, he could have stopped right here and just said marriage is honorable in all, and he would have covered the act of marriage. But just lest anyone misunderstand, he says, and the bed undefiled. I looked up the word bed in the Greek. I remember my Greek professor said that's always a good thing to do. So before I rushed into print on this, I thought I'd better make sure some translator hadn't thrown me a curve and that bed didn't mean bed. And I found to my interest that the word in the Greek is koite. Sound familiar? That's the word through the Latin wherein we get our English word coitus. And it means exactly in the Greek what coitus means in the English, the act of impregnation. Therefore, what the Holy Spirit is saying is marriage is honorable in all and impregnation undefiled. Not just casual impregnation, but marital impregnation. That makes all the difference in the world. Now, I know some of you say, well, I thought the Bible had a lot of things to say against sex. You're right, it does. That's why I like to distinguish between the two. I do not like to refer to the act of marriage as sex. In fact, now I know I'm stretching the point because technically it can be used. But I like to use the term act of marriage for a married couple and sex for anyone outside of marriage, before or after or anything else, outside of marriage. And interestingly enough, every time the Bible refers to sex outside of marriage, it always condemns it, prohibits it. Every time it refers to the act of marriage, it commends it. I have yet to find one condemnation against the act of marriage in the entire Bible. Which means God is the author of our drives. And every human being has been given a drive for the opposite sex. Now, that's not to pervert us or to twist us, but it's to enrich us and ennoble us and to fulfill us. And to not only fulfill our family, but to fulfill our emotion, to express our feelings and many other things. And the beauty of it is, this is an experience that has been enjoyed by people from all educational levels and all socioeconomic levels down through the years. Throughout the world, most people have lived in what we Americans consider abject poverty. And yet they have had this sublime experience that can be a meaningful, pleasurable, satisfying function in life if it is confined to marriage and if it is an expression of love. The act of marriage should always be an expression of love. Now, in addition to being an expression of love, it should be expressed or fulfilled with wisdom. That's why we recommend that a person understand something about his own function and the function of his partner. God has never put a priority on ignorance, and I see no reason why we should gloss over the subject. In fact, we seem to go from one to another extreme, from total ignorance on the subject and just assume, well, we get married and it all works out. And it doesn't always work out happily. Or the other extreme that the public school has gone to today, where they inundate kindergartners through 12th grade with massive doses. You'd think they're trying to get everyone to be a gynecologist on this subject or equivalent in knowledge before they get out of high school. And I don't recommend that either. Instead, they need to be taught morality and decency before marriage and then put on a crash course just before they get married and learn the intimate details. We need to know general concepts before that time, but before marriage, we need to stimulate our reading and our counseling and our parental discussion. Those are the three primary areas of information. We're fortunate today to have many good books, and I'm not just talking about The Act of Marriage. Naturally, I wouldn't be objective if I said it was less than the best, but in the last 10 years, there have occurred a number of good books on this subject that are helpful. There are a lot of books that are not worth reading. One of the things we tried to do was take the more recent scientific data and put it in terms that would not be objectionable to the Christian community. Much of the other stuff is just unreadable by Christians. But today, there are good materials. Do you know, when Bev and I got married, we couldn't find one good book on the subject. In fact, I don't think Christians advertise that you read anything on that subject. It's just one of those things we never talk about. You know what our pastoral counseling consisted of? I can give it to you quickly. My wife's pastor was one of the finest Bible teachers in the state of Michigan, and I can see him as if it were yesterday. We were two innocent kids in his office getting his advice, and he whipped out his pocket watch, and he looked at it nervously, and here's his advice to us. Now, don't forget, I want you here early. The wedding starts at 7:30, so you be here at 7 o'clock. And that was our premarital counseling. Now, fortunately, pastors have updated their technique a good deal, and you'll find that most Bible-believing pastors talk to their young people frankly about the act of marriage today. Do you know why that's necessary? It's his voice that has thundered from the pulpit morality and decency and virtue and honor. Now they need to hear his voice say, there is one glorious exception. It's called marriage. And it's the same with the parents. I think it's ideal when the daughter can have a chat with her mother, and that mother can give her a good, positive mental attitude toward the act of marriage. And father, talk to the boys. And I'll warn you, it'll be the hardest sex talk you ever give in your life. I've given lots of them, but the toughest one I ever gave was out in the garage with my son. Something about looking into the eyes of your own flesh and blood, it's makes you nervous, and you break out with goosebumps and get embarrassed, and they get embarrassed, but it's worth it. 10 days after he came home from his honeymoon, my son was out in the garage doing something, and I came out there, and he's not a talker like I am. He cleared his throat, and he said, Dad, remember when we were here the last time? How could I forget? And I said, yes. He just looked me in the eye and he said, I want to thank you. That's all he said. It spoke volumes to me. I think it's very important for parents to talk frankly to their young people just before marriage. They need to hear you approve that beautiful relationship. Your lovely daughter doesn't need, as she walks down the hall of her motel on her wedding night, to think, good grief, I wonder what my parents would think of me now. She needs to know what her parents would think. Sweetheart, this is why God made you the way you are, and we're for you. This is a beautiful and wonderful thing. That mental attitude is a great preparation for a beautiful relationship. And then what's wrong with our learning by doing? Now, the educational world would have young people believe if you haven't experimented a lot of times before you get married, you don't really need you don't really know what you're getting into. Well, I found in my survey of 3,400 married people that were predominantly Christians that the folks who had no experimentation before marriage had a higher satisfaction level after marriage than those who did. And I was encouraged to find that the University of Ohio made a survey of that very subject of couples that had lived together for a long period of time before they got married. And to their amazement, couples who had no physical relationship before they got married had a happier married life 5 years after they got married than those who had lived together. Now, experimentation is the world's wisdom, and that's almost invariably wrong. They may be right when it comes to the absolutes. 2 + 2 = 4, whether you're a humanist or a Christian. But whenever it comes to the practical, interpersonal relationship or moral standards, they're almost invariably wrong. Now, you see, the world has the wrong idea. You don't have to have a gynecologist's intelligence of this subject in order to have a good relationship, but you do have to be unselfish. In my counseling experience, there are three sexual encounters that stand out as the most wretched experiences I've ever had. That is, people who came to me with the most deplorable sexual problems. And to your interest, two of them were medical doctors, the first one and the third one, and the second most severe case was a professional athlete. And I look at those two doctors, and I think of the third one that came in about 3.5, 4 years ago, and as I'm listening to this doctor with a registered nurse wife telling me about the terrible sex life they have, and I'm thinking, now what can I as a minister tell him that he doesn't already know 5 times? And that's when it really got through my thick head that knowledge of anatomy is not the guarantee of a good physical relationship. Because the one thing all three of those people had in common was they were completely obsessed with self. You see, two young people who love each other unselfishly will somehow work it out. However, some of these steps will save them a lot of trial and error in anticipating what to expect. All right, once you've established a good understanding of both the male and female reproductive system and the relationship, let's consider what it really means, first of all, to the husband. What does the act of marriage really mean to a man? Well, I don't have to prove the fact that it satisfies his sex drive, which is very normal. And I'd like to suggest that if you're a married woman, your husband is in all likelihood very normal. I meet every now and then some wife who thinks her husband is oversexed. And I ask her a few questions and then she seems disappointed to find that he's very normal. That drive that is in him is not something he cultivates. It's not something he necessarily encourages. It is there as an act of God. Do you realize that the normal, everyday, average male can manufacture over 500,000 sperm cells in a single week? Is it any wonder he has a drive in that area? God gave him that drive. Nothing wrong with it. And in marriage, he cultivates the satisfaction of that drive, which only incurs an increasing desire for its satisfaction. It's part of God's plan for marital happiness. Second, it fulfills his manhood. And that's almost as important as the first because it is intrinsically tied in with his sex drive. A man's satisfaction and acceptance of himself as a man is intrinsically tied to his sex drive. You show me a man that is frustrated in his marital harmony with his wife, and I'll show you a man who's insecure about his manhood. On the same day, I counseled two men, one a professional athlete, who just had no confidence in himself as a man. And as I looked at this hulking brute, I thought if ever there was a man that was the embodiment of virility, it was this man. And here he was having impotence problems, he was having insecurity problems and all the rest. Before the day was over, I was dealing with a man who was gifted in the cerebral areas, but admitted to me, you know, when it comes to coordination, I just don't have it. I feel like I've got two left feet on one body. I can't catch a football, I can't throw a baseball, but the guy was very mature in the acceptance of his manhood. Interestingly enough, he had a full-orbed relationship with his wife. One of the great contributions a woman can make to her husband is the fulfillment of his God-given sex drive because it will help him better accept and use his manhood. It'll make him easier to live with around the home. It'll make him a better father most of the time. Third, it will stimulate his love for his wife. Now, I'd like to explain this because those who have violated the moral standards of God or engage themselves in a promiscuous life, they just don't think the way we do. And those of us who have lived a chaste life according to the principles of God because we were taught this, we just can't understand and think like the promiscuous concepts. It's just, they're two different worlds. But I'd like to explain one of the benefits of thinking the thoughts of God and observing God's rules and standards in this area. There are only three ways a man can have his sex drive satisfied. One is the act of marriage. Two is self-manipulation. Three is prostitution or illegitimacy covers it all. Now, only those three ways. Now, here you have a man who has a biological force that God has given him that is crying out for release. And there are only three ways that it can be satisfied. These two, self-manipulation and illegitimacy in any of its forms, are invariably followed by shame, guilt, remorse, and a feeling of inadequacy. Unless they have been indulged so many times, you sear the conscience as with a hot iron. That can be done, but it takes a long time, and I'm assuming that we don't have that kind of people present in a seminar like this. So for most such individuals, most people that are moral and basically faithful to one person, these two are entirely unsatisfactory. However, the act of marriage is followed by a sense of fulfillment, of worthwhile acceptance and enrichment. And unless the person has an entirely faulty view, it is never followed by guilt. Consequently, since there's only one person with whom a man can have this necessary experience without guilt, it will naturally increase his love for that one object of the expression of his affection, without guilt. And ladies, I cannot stress too much how important it is for a man not to have the problem of guilt after the expression of the biology. You have a special corner on relationship in that man's life, and it will stimulate his love for you. Fourth, it will reduce minor friction in the home. I'm sorry, we forgot the word minor. It's got to be there. This will not repair the bent fender on the car, and it won't overlook the overdrawn checking account either. But it will make him easier to live with around the house, and I'm sure anyone married any length of time has already made that observation. And fifth, it will provide a man with life's most exciting experience. I don't believe there's a red-blooded man anywhere who has had a regular experience that he would say is more exciting than the act of marriage. Now, I read about a fellow that dove out of an airplane, one of these skydivers, and he was out over the Mojave Desert. Now, this is a true story, if you can believe the newspaper. And he pulled a ripcord, and nothing happened. But he was a veteran. He'd free-fallen 10,000 feet and just floating around, steering himself. And he pulled the cord, nothing happened, but he knew he had another cord, so he jerked the emergency, that's a smaller one, to pull out the big one, and the thing came off in his hand. And he fell all the way to the ground, and would you believe he landed in a 3.5-foot-wide creek bed and sank right down into the mud. And he just knew he was dead. But he, you know, his senses weren't out, so he got to thinking, where am I? It wasn't hot, and it wasn't beautiful. So he finally sat up, and he realized he was still on Earth, and he couldn't understand how come he wasn't dead, but he got up and thought, well, he's blind. But then he discovered he just had mud on his goggles, so he pulled that off. They took him to the hospital, and after a day and a half, they released him a little bruised and battered and a little bit sore, but as far as they could tell, undamaged. Now, I'm sure if I said to him, what is the most exciting experience you ever had, he would mention that. But I'm talking about repeat performances, you understand. All right, what does the act of marriage mean to a woman? First of all, it will fulfill her self-image. More important to a woman in the act of marriage is her acceptance of herself as a woman. This is so important. Before she's married, she can learn self-acceptance in many fields. She has nothing to prove in this area. Better not. God has said no. But as soon as she gets married, there's another whole dimension wherein she has to bring fulfillment, not only to herself, but satisfaction to a partner. And what her husband thinks of her is of great importance. That's one of the reasons, men, I like to stress that you should always use your mouth to approve your wife. Nothing is more devastating to a woman than verbalized disapproval by the man she loves. You can destroy her. And particularly in this area, it is important for a man to reassure her. Now, if things aren't working out right, talk about it openly. Don't let it build up until you get angry and then say nasty, unkind things, because they're devastating to a woman. But it is important to a woman that she accept herself as a married woman. That's why she should work at a mutually satisfying physical relationship in this area. Second, it satisfies her sex drive when properly consummated. Unfortunately, many couples do not learn the art of mutual satisfaction. And I want to stress the fact that that is not something innate. It is an art, a technique that must be learned. And it is important that both learn. It takes two people. That's one of the reasons that it is a little difficult. Not impossible, and it can be learned in a relatively short period of time, particularly if you read the right materials and get the right counsel. But it's important to satisfy a woman's drive in this area. In recent years, by the way, we have come to realize that a woman does have a drive here. And may I give a frank suggestion to you, lovely wives? When you have that feeling, don't squelch it. For some reason or other, nice, wholesome, chaste women have a feeling that it wouldn't be right if they would ever indicate to their husband that they have a good, warm, amorous spirit. I don't know where you ever got that notion. I've counseled over 2,500 couples. I've never heard one man complain about that. All the complaints I've heard have been just the opposite. So if you have a desire in this area toward your husband, and that's the only direction it should take, express it. I would caution you to one thing. That's usually the time of your highest fertility capability. But proceed with caution. Third, it reassures her of her husband's love. And that's so important in this over-sex-stimulated age in which we live. And let's face it, our parents didn't have the sexual temptations that both of us are faced with today. And it is more important today to have a sublime physical relationship between married couples than ever before. It reduces outside temptations. And I encourage Christians to work on it for that reason, if for nothing else. There are other reasons, but that's certainly one good one. Because when you send your husband off at 7 o'clock in the morning to work, you know that he probably works in a school or a plant or an office with a host of other women, other men's wives. And they come on there for 8 hours and they're strapped in and laced up and painted on. They put their best foot forward and anything else they may have to offer. And you're not sure just how attractive that person is going to be. And by the way, this business of divorce has increased in direct proportion as men and women working together in the labor force has increased. Promiscuity and infidelity are one of the greatest causes of divorce, and I attribute it largely to men and women working together for long periods of time in the labor force. Now, I know it's something that's forced on us, but one of the best antidotes to that is a good, reassuring love relationship with your partner. Fourth, it will relax a woman's nervous system. Our reproductive system is one of the very important relaxant agents of our nervous system. It's not the only one, but it is a very significant one. And fifth, when properly consummated, it provides a wife with her most exciting physical experience. And I don't believe any woman who has enjoyed the art of mutual satisfaction in marriage will argue that that is life's most exciting physical experience. Now, get my point. Number five is identical for both the husband and wife. I think it's beautiful that God has designed a husband and wife so that in the intimacy of their own love, they have life's most exciting experience only with each other. You see, God designed it to be an exclusive experience that we share uniquely with each other. In fact, it's one of the few things we save just for each other. You share your partner in almost every other area, don't you? If your partner's a good cook, you share her culinary arts. If your husband is a good mechanic, you share that ability with other people. Maybe that's the way he makes his living, sharing it. You just share each other in every dimension, except this one. This one is unshared and unshareable in the plan of God because the two of you have a unique relationship. And what other people are doing is really not overly consequential. What is important is the uniqueness of your love relationship. I am convinced that no couple should settle for anything less than mutual satisfaction. And toward that end, may I give some suggestions for the husband first and then to the wife. I'll give these quickly. First of all, because it is so much easier for a man to find physical satisfaction in the act of marriage, it is imperative that he practice self-control. As a young man, that may be very difficult, but he needs to seek the grace of God and in his love for his wife, practice that control, and instead seek his wife's satisfaction. The man that goes into the act of marriage to satisfy his wife will soon learn. The man who goes in just to get his own satisfaction will destroy a relationship. Third, remember what stimulates a woman. It isn't sight, it's words and tender touch. One of the graphic areas that men and women are different is their sensory perception. Men are eye-stimulated. I don't have to expound on that. We're all aware of it. Certainly advertising agencies are well aware of it. I was driving down the freeway the other day. If there's anything I think is completely unglamorous, it's truck tires. And I looked over on a billboard, and here is one of those ugly, great, big truck tires. Why, that wouldn't even attract the interest of a truck driver. And I look over there, and every truck driver that drove by was looking at those truck tires. Why? They had placed a half-clad cutie's picture hanging over the edge of that truck tire. And they wanted to sell their truck tires. They've just learned. Why? Men are stimulated by... not women. Most men don't understand this. They think that, you know, strutting around and flexing your muscles... well, that isn't a very good example, but, you know... flexing your muscles, that doesn't do it. I saw this graphically the other day when I was whipping through my son's Sports Illustrated magazine, and I came on this 36-year-old fellow from Detroit that had just won the Mr. America contest. That's usually won by a 23- or 24-year-old, and so I was pretty impressed that someone close to my vintage got it. And as I'm looking at this magnificent body, Bev walked up behind me, looked over my shoulder, and her instant response was, "Yuck! How grotesque!" I thought it was pretty neat. You see, a man and a woman just see things differently. Now, what does turn a woman on if it isn't sight? I'll tell you what it is. It's words. Who is it that goes to a rock concert and screams and hollers and faints and falls all over the place? I'll admit that's a little extreme, but who is it that does that? Not very many guys. Lots of girls just go out of their tree. Why? There's something about the female auditory response mechanism. Now, men, you can use that or abuse that. How did she marry you in the first place? Because you kept screaming at her? Never heard of anyone marry under those circumstances. No, you whispered sweet nothings. Now, sweet nothings whispered in your ear don't really do a lot for you. But whispered in her ear, they do a lot for her. Why? She's a woman. And there's something about sounds, and your voice is evidently on her wavelength. Doesn't matter whether your voice is high or low. Every woman's set a little different. And the fact that she responded to you indicates that your voice is on her receiver set. So when you walk in at night, visualize that auditory receiver like the thermometer on the wall, or the, you know, you can either, not the thermometer, what is that, the thermostat, thank you. You can either turn that thermostat up, or you can turn it down. So if you want to crawl into bed with an iceberg, just yell and criticize and carp all night. But if you want to have a warm reception, just turn on your charm and approve and encourage and love. You see, the act of marriage shouldn't be a spontaneous thing. It should be an ultimate expression of many things, consciously and subconsciously. And she's listening for those things and, of course, tender touch. I know of very few normal women that like brutality and sadistic treatment. If they do, they've got some problems. Fourth, observe daily hygiene. I think that's self-explanatory. Fortunately, today we have lots of helps. When they have a water shortage, just get a bigger can and spray it on. Fifth, communicate freely. Communicate freely. I cannot overemphasize the necessity of communication. Every case where I've been brought into a couple that cannot relate sexually, they have ceased talking honestly about this subject. And I'm going to make you a statement. I hope you'll remember this and apply it, if not for yourselves, for other people that hopefully you can help. But if a couple comes away from their honeymoon without working out a good, mutually satisfying physical relationship, then it becomes increasingly more difficult to talk about it with every passing year. I had one couple tell me they had not discussed their intimate relationship for 25 years. And they had a dreadful relationship. Do you know how long it took to straighten it out? 3 weeks. The problem was not that complex. It was just that they were doing the wrong thing consistently for over 25 years, and they weren't talking about it. I'm convinced any couple that comes away from their honeymoon and they've learned to talk about it, it won't be long before they can learn the art of mutual satisfaction. All right, what are some suggestions to a wife? Number one, it is imperative that you maintain a positive mental attitude. Whatever the background, and if you happen to have been raised in a family where they thought it was dirty or ugly, remove from your mind, for the Lord's sake and your partner's sake, those unscriptural concepts and anticipate it as a beautiful gift of God, because your mental attitude is everything. Maribel Morgan is right on target in one thing she said in her book. She said a woman's most important sex organ is her brain. And that is so true. If your brain is confused, it doesn't matter what else you've got. That is also going to be confused. Positive mental attitude. Second, relax. Don't be surprised if you're uptight when you're on your honeymoon. In fact, I'd be surprised if a young, innocent girl went on her honeymoon and she was completely relaxed. Now, that's unnatural. Because everything we do the first time is kind of a scary thing. Remember the first time you drove a car? You were really panicky. Now you drive it without a second thought. Obviously, people up here drive without a second thought. And in San Diego, too. But how do you get that way from being uptight about driving until where you do it by second nature? Repetition. Repetition is an aid to learning, and it also helps us to relax. A woman should recognize that she is a responder. Most wives need to burn this into their brain. Here your husband comes in and he's visually stimulated. You're the most beautiful thing in all the world to him, because with a man there's something about possession makes it always more beautiful. You notice he always polishes his car. He doesn't run down and polish the neighbor's car. It's his. And something about ownership is super special to a man. And so when he walks in the door and he sees you, don't be surprised if he responds with amorous thoughts and suggestions. Now, right there, when he walks up to you and puts his arm around you, what are you thinking about? The kids and dinner and the family that's coming over to visit that night and other things. And you're not at all responsive to him. May I offer you a suggestion? If you just stand there in his arms for anywhere from 30 seconds to 57 seconds, depending on your temperament, you will respond to his mood. You see, it isn't a matter of, oh, here we go again. It's a matter of waiting. Certainly, he hasn't hidden his feeling. But you see, God will ignite you. God has designed you so that you respond to him. But most wives don't understand that. And they cut themselves off and their husband off with the first 15 or 20 seconds and cheat both of them out of a very enjoyable experience. You say, well, what about the dinner? Shut it off. I never heard of a husband complain about a cold dinner because of love. Never. Observe daily feminine hygiene for the same reason. Communicate freely. Ladies, it is so important that you tell your husband about you. You know something? Most husbands don't know a thing about women when they get married. Really. How in the world would they ever know? Who's going to tell them? Their sister? Certainly not. In fact, most of the things they do know are wrong because they've learned about them from fellas. And I have learned after 2 years in the Air Force and dealing with a lot of men through the years, I've come to this conclusion. When this is one subject about which men are notorious liars. I remember the big boys in the barracks used to come and tell us all about their exploits. You know, I sat there 18 years old, a product of a good fundamental church and had no prior experience. I'd sit there and my eyes would get about that big. Now every now and then I'll think back to one of those things or one of those stories and I realize what they said was totally impossible. Most young Christian gals get married and they just figure, well, I don't know anything about it, but I'm sure he does. And the poor guy doesn't, but he's too masculine and proud of his masculinity to admit he doesn't. Why don't you just get married and just assume he doesn't know anything about girls? He doesn't have to. He only has to learn about one. But you have to tell him what you find enjoyable, exciting, responsive. It's so important that you both communicate freely. And when all else fails, pray. I don't believe any Christian couple should settle for a second-rate physical relationship. I cannot impress that too heavily upon your mind. Because your Heavenly Father designed you the way you are, with all of the capabilities built into your physical and reproductive system. And he says in his word, in all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. If you have an area of lack of fulfillment in this experience, I suggest that you pray about it and let God work a miracle on your behalf. I said at the outset I would prove to you before I finish that Christians enjoy the sublimities of the act of marriage more than anyone else. When Zondervan asked us to write the book, The Act of Marriage, they said there's a need for a hard-hitting, frank book by a Christian on this subject. I said, okay, I'll write it on one condition, that I can either prove or disprove my presupposition that Christians enjoy this experience more than anyone else. They said, well, how will you do that? I said, well, we'll have to take a survey. There are lots of sex surveys of the secular world, but there's never been one made of Christians. And since I had a number of names and addresses of couples who had attended our seminars, I sent out a letter to 12,000 people, told them what I was going to do, and offered a free copy of the book if a couple would take the survey. And I had 1,700 people take the survey of 95 questions on pink paper for women and on blue paper for men. Slightly different. Many of the questions basic, but some were individual. In any case, we cranked it all into the computer, and I was trying to establish many things, one of which was that Christians do register a higher satisfaction level. To my amazement, it came back 81%. Now, the next highest survey of the secular world was 58%. And then I had a credibility problem. If it had been 68%, I'd have rushed out into print and said, see? But 81, who's going to believe that big a change? I knew Christians enjoyed it more, but not that much more. And while I'm deliberating this, I'd even thought I'd just leave that whole chapter out of the book. And a nurse in the church that we had talked this over with on several occasions called and said, have you seen Red Book magazine? They've just published a new survey by Max Levine of 100,000 women readers of Red Book. And I said, no, I haven't. So I went down, bought the magazine, and lo and behold, their number one impression was, and I quote, that strong, religiously inclined women registered a higher satisfaction level than non-religious. And do you know what it was? 71%. And I said, okay, now how can I account for that 10% differential? Well, it's very simple. I looked at their listing of religious. They had Protestants, Jews, Catholics, Mohammedans, Buddhists, anybody, you know what mine consisted of? 98% profess to be born-again Christians. And yes, I think I could accept that. And just about the time I wound up the chapter, I remembered another question I'd asked that was, I asked actually too many questions to put on our computer. And so I ran this through special. The question was, do you consider yourself basically a spirit-controlled Christian most of the time? Do you understand, do you not understand what the spirit-filled life is, or are you not a spirit-filled Christian? Those were the three options. So we just took those who said, yes, I basically consider myself a spirit-controlled Christian most of the time, and I cranked their satisfaction level back into the computer, and you know what it read out? 89%. And you see, that more graphically prove my fundamental idea. You see, I had the idea years ago that Christians enjoyed this relationship more because if we're filled with the Spirit, the first characteristic of the Spirit is what? Love. And if you have a heart filled with love toward the person that is proper to express that love with, then you're going to express it more and more meaningfully. And I think statistics now prove that the closer we are to God, the closer we are to each other. And when I think about that, just as a pastor with a heart that I'm sure you share for the souls of people, I think of how many people I have tried to get to accept Jesus Christ, and they had the weird idea, boy, if I accept Jesus Christ, then all the great pleasures of life will be held from me, not realizing He enriches all the pleasures of life. Even this sublime experience.